Hey, everybody. As the co-host of your Chillpack Hollywood Hour, it's always delightful to shoot the transatlantic breeze with the UK Midweek Drive team. Together, we aim to provide the best possible audio backdrop for political sanity in the 21st century. This is Phil Lairness, reporting from the middle ground between science and superstition. And you have entered the podcast zone.
It's a wonderful month, May, because we're getting through all wonderful things, and we can welcome back to the Midweek Drive the awesomely talented Armin Shimerman. Welcome, Armin. How are you?
Very fine, thank you. Very fine indeed.
Excellent. Well, we'll hopefully be joined in the not-too-distant future by Professor Jason Whittaker. But as you may have gathered, I always believe that the scenery is so much better when we actually start talking about radio in so many ways. It's the theater of the mind. And much as in really one of your texts, you can actually lose yourself in the text of Illyria. And suddenly it's just a whole wealth of sort of information that comes in terms of the sequence there. So I have to ask the question, because it's already being asked this side of the Atlantic. How is the sequel coming on? How is part two of the Illyria thing emerging?
The sequel is coming well. I'm in the process of rewrites. My editor and I have been collaborating over ways to make the story better. There are three books to this trilogy, obviously, and the second and third book have already been written, but the polish is what makes it better. But it's coming very well. I'm very close to the first or second polish of the second book. And my editor, God bless her, Gia, has suggested a couple of things that will make the story much more exciting, much more appealing, and hopefully we'll get to the end of the story and of the adventure.
I can scarce believe that's possible, Armin. I mean, after the first one, and again, I stand by this, and I've even put it forward as one of our next book of the months in terms of Southside Broadcasting and Siren Radio, at least, because we do, obviously, as its name suggests, it's a bit like, yes, a trilogy has three books, book of the month, we have one per month, where we actually look at that sequence, and I think certainly it'll be entering those hallowed halls, very much so. But meanwhile, of course, you're still teaching, you're still involved with respect to the Shakespeare work and so on. How has that been progressing?
Not very well. My teaching has been put on hold, mainly because I do not like to teach over Zoom. And right now in the United States, most schools, most classrooms are conducted via Zoom. I like talking to you over Zoom. That's great. That's wonderful. That's worthwhile. But teaching acting via Zoom is not conducive to anyone really getting anything. You need to be part of the chemistry that's happening in the room in order to teach acting. You need to see the subtle things that are happening in the eyes of the people at the same time. Zoom does not allow that. In fact, sometimes in a scene, people overlap, they talk to each other. You can't do that on Zoom. So I have asked all the people, the powers that be, that to not use me during this pandemic until I can get back into the classroom and be in the presence of the people that are doing their work. So that has been put on hold. I continue to be part of workshops where Shakespeare is discussed, and I add my two cents there. And I'm very happy to say that several of my students have just been hired and have just started a phenomenally important Shakespeare Festival in Utah, in the United States, called the Utah Shakespeare Festival. They've just started rehearsal this week, and I'm very proud of the fact that that my students have done so well that they were able to get positions where people from all over our country were vying for. Hundreds of people have auditioned for this particular wonderful Shakespeare Festival, and I'm very proud that two of my students are there this summer.
But Armin, that surely means you have the Shimerman seal of approval. And if you get the Shimerman seal, that's almost like picking up an Academy Award in many ways. It's great stuff.
It is. Thank you for that. Thank you very much, Alex. I will leave it at that. I don't think I can expound upon that.
I mean, it is interesting though, because this is my 17th interactive video today, because we had 12 student assessments. I had a number of other interviews as well that we were working through. And it is intriguing in terms of, yes, the students are obviously developing their skill set when it comes to Microsoft Teams, when it comes to Blackboard Collaborate, all these new technologies, which clearly back in the 20th century were the stuff of science fiction. And yet, you know, we're finally working through that process. And I have to say, in some instances, albeit with the caveats you've raised there in terms of you need to ensure that timing is right, and sometimes the connection can be a little bit skewy, et cetera, it does seem to be an interesting asset. I mean, I don't think we're going to go back. The genie is not going to be put back in the bottle. I think this video thing will probably be with us for some time, I suspect.
I suspect it will be. And in many fields, I believe it's probably a good thing. I just don't think it's a good thing in my field, especially in the theater. Because obviously, the moment you start broadcasting, it's no longer theater, it's TV or film. So just by definition, it's something else. But in theater, one needs the audience, the actors, the scenery, all to be in the same place so that you're experiencing it as though you were living it. An actor's role in society is to create catharsis in the audience. And if the audience has the ability to turn away, then that catharsis is limited.
One of our regular correspondents, of course, from San Diego is Gene Bruce Scott. And together with Randy Reinholtz, they co-founded the Native Voices company. Gene's with us, I would say, in the not too distant future, actually. But she's also sort of very much of that belief that actually the cathartic element of the acting profession is something which is really part of the magic of the whole field, really. You know, we can utter the words, we can say the words William Blake, for instance, and instantly on saying the words William Blake, our scholar extraordinaire, Professor Jason Whittaker, will appear and actually say it's all there, as indeed will Rebecca. You see, Armin, this is clearly the sort of magic of the media of Zoom. By actually just having Illyria in the background there, it opens up a whole range of other bits and pieces. And in fact, you know, the more one thinks about it, I think as we welcome the whole thing, the team together, I almost feel as though we're being looked over by perhaps, as I say, the great cosmic architect himself in all sorts of ways. What say you, Jason? Do you think that the great cosmic architect is possibly looking after us as Kirsty Barrett joins us as well?
Oh, the great cosmic architect in Blake's work is Urizen, who is actually the, you know, false god. He's the guy on the cloud who believes he knows everything and actually knows nothing. So that architect is, as you say, behind you. Fantastic. He is anything but looking out for us. He kind of wants to condemn us to a world of misery and pain.
Yeah. Well, that was Donald Trump, of course. Armin thankfully got rid of that. So all's well with the world. We'll do our introductions now for the benefit of the listener who's actually just joined us. Of course, we have Professor Jason Whittaker, Kirsty Barrett, and the welcome Rebecca Bond. Of course, Rebecca, indeed, you actually have Jason as your dissertation supervisor, I believe.
Not as my supervisor, no, I'm actually doing my English dissertation, but we did have a good chat actually and define how my topic was going to go ahead, and it's going really well. So,
well, that's perfect. That's what we like to see. And Kirsty, actually, Armin, is also in charge of our Festival of Learning. She's the communications officer for the University of Lincoln's Festival of Learning system, in which she's sort of addressing a whole range of factors there, and probably also is sharing the joys of Zoom, etc. Of course, your good self, Armin, awesome in so many ways. We're also connected now by the fabulous Juliette Lamar, who, like yourself, Armin, is celebrating, I think it's at 9 a.m. in Los Angeles time. How are you, Juliette? She'll be okay, won't she, actually unmute so we get the microphone coming through. We'll be able to hear you soon, Juliette, I'm sure. All will come through. Anyway.
Project.
Exactly. It's the way forward. Jason, any questions you'd like to share with Armin, who obviously is a keen William Shakespeare scholar, as we mentioned, and professor and so on, as well as obviously all sorts of other exciting things that tend to emerge. Anything you'd like to sort of ask at this particular stage, Jason? And in fact, is there a collaboration between Blake? What was Blake's views about Shakespeare?
So Blake was actually, lots of people who know something about William Blake tend to know about the connection to John Milton, Paradise Lost in particular. But actually prior to the influence of Milton, Blake was more influenced by Shakespeare. So actually in his first collection of poetry, poetical sketches, which he wrote between the ages of 14 and 21. There's a number of, frankly, young imitations of Shakespeare. King Edward III, I think, is one that plays. You know, he's trying to write in a Shakespearean mode. And once you realise that, you realise that a lot of the poetry in his prophetic books isn't actually Miltonic, it's Shakespearean. He's actually trying to emulate the kind of the weightier speeches that come from Milton. So it's really actually, my question for you would be, have you ever explored any of those relations between Shakespeare and Blake?
No, I'm afraid I haven't. I've always been intrigued by Blake. I haven't done as much reading of Blake as perhaps I should have. My focus has always been a little bit earlier, Shakespearean and the playwrights and the poets of that time. But Blake is a great, wonderful poet. And I'm sure that his interest in angels and my lead character's interest in angels was very similar, and I perhaps should explore that.
Thank you.
If nothing else, Armin, we like to actually share those cross-fertilization of ideas through these Zoom things. Juliet, hopefully we can now actually hear you. If you unmute yourself, all will be set and ready to go. Welcome to the Midweek Drive. Of course, your second edition of this. How are you keeping?
I'm doing so well. I'm just fabulous to be invited back. So good to see you again.
You're still very quiet. We could hear you, barely. I could obviously turn up the gain, etc. Maybe just tweak it up a little bit. All will be marvellous. But share with us.
How about now?
Oh, now that's projection. As Armin would say, that is projection.
It's the headphones. I swear, Zoom hates them.
it's okay, because I mean, again, the ultimate sort of line with respect to headphones is effectively, again, consistently changing the background. I always get the feeling you're looking over my shoulder in one way, shape or form. And I don't know whereabouts you happen to be on that basis, but what the hey. What are you getting up to at present, Juliet? What's your life involving?
Oh, my goodness. You know, like all creative people, we have 1,000 loose ends to tie up on a daily basis. But currently working on my media company, that Off-Topic Media, we're going to be launching to help people who want to do podcasting and vodcasting. And really what we're doing here, have a platform and really some creative guidance on how to actually get it off the ground. So many creatives, including myself, you know, it takes a while to get your ideas off the ground, and you just need a little bit of mentorship and maybe some connection of the dots. And so that's what I've been working on with Off Topic Media. So got that. And of course, you know, local hyper-journalism never sleeps.
Local hyper-journalism. I mean, you know, those are words that could be taken from a Jason Whittaker lecture to third years, could they not, Jason? To bring you in briefly, Kirsty, any questions you'd like to put to the team so far? I mean, you've got Armin, you've got Juliet, we're bringing Rebecca as well shortly. Jason, of course, where do you want to go from your base in wonderful Norwich, England?
Well, I have questions for both of you, so I'll start with my question for Armin. So I saw online that you've been involved a lot in the trek against pancreatic cancer. What made you want to be involved in that cause?
Thank you for that. That's an excellent question. And thank you for bringing it up. So there are many reasons. I guess the primary reason, and the one that most people would understand, is that about 17 years ago, my wife was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. At that time, there was a survival rate of about 4%. She is one of the lucky ones. She is still with us. I hope she'll outlive me. That would be great. But at this point, it's only a 10% survival rate. It is essential that we do something in order to make it 100%. Cancer is a devastating disease, not only pancreatic cancer, but all cancers. And the more that we can do to raise money, to raise awareness, in order to tell the people, to tell the doctors, tell the medical support systems that we need to do better. That's an important work, and I was very happy to volunteer for that. I'm happy to say that our drive has just concluded, and thanks to the efforts of myself, my wife Kitty Swink, my good friend Jonathan Frakes, we raised $62,000 for PanCAN, and there were other campaigns as well. Pancreatic cancer is becoming the second most virulent cancer around, and we need to do something to stop that.
I think that deserves a Zoom out of sync round of applause, Armin. Absolutely brilliant stuff on that particular side. Well done indeed. Kirsty, carry on. Who do you wish to speak to next?
I have one final question for Armin, and then I have a question for Juliet as well. So with many episodes of Deep Space Nine, they are seen as metaphors for social evils. And what episode do you believe is the most prominent to the issues of the modern world?
Sure. I'm very proud of an episode the week that is called Far Beyond the Stars, which has to do with racism, not only in the United States, but I believe everywhere. And you're absolutely right. Star Trek was always created to be a metaphor for social evils. They never give you an answer, but they pose the question, and it's left to the audience to decide how they feel after watching an episode. But Far Beyond the Stars is one of my proudest episodes. I'm everyone involved, whether it was Avery who directed it, or all the people who wrote it, and certainly the actors who performed it. It is a great, great episode. It is not only good Star Trek, it is superb television. And I recommend that episode to anyone who wants to be introduced to the Star Trek franchise or to the to our particular show, Deep Space Nine.
It's interesting. Back in the day, Armin, at the start of the 20th century, 21st century, I should say, I was actually keen to actually promote that particular one, and indeed used it as part of my teaching strategies as well for a contemporary issues class that we were working on there. So I can certainly endorse that. It's a definite classic and well worth sort of accessing in all sorts of ways there. We'll actually put it onto a Resonance Rewind before too long. Back to you, Kirsty. We're putting you in anchor position now.
No, don't worry, I'll happily take the role. And Juliet, so why do you think that podcasts are so popular in a generation that some may argue has been involved in the death of radio?
Podcasting, I think it's popular because the current structure of what a lot of people, not all, thank goodness, believe to be successful is constant hustle. You're constantly on the go. You constantly have projects going. If you're not busy, you're not doing anything. I don't believe that personally, but that's kind of this culture that we're seeing with a lot of people who are millennials and Gen Z. And podcasts give you the ability to learn and to be involved in something, whether you're driving, whether you're walking, while you're multitasking. So I think number one, that's why it's so popular. It's the multitasking aspect of being able to listen. Although it is just radio on the internet, you know, it is the same thing basically. And then also, you know, we live in a time where anyone can create their own platform, right? We have Instagram where you are your own brand, you are your own storyteller. Podcasting is just another aspect of that. The barrier to entry is quite low. If you want to have a podcast, you simply have to have a connection to the internet and a way to record it, whether that's a smartphone or a whole studio full of equipment. So the barrier to entry is quite low. And really, it's just up to your own creative ideas to really be successful or not. Of course, there's a lot of other tiny aspects that go into it. But I think that's why it's become so popular and why everyone has a podcast. Is because you can do it and you can just start it without any doors being opened for you. It's not like you have to have an agent or you have to have a network. You can just start and the possibilities are endless. And that's something that's wonderful, but also I think causes a lot more competition. And it's hard to rise to the top when there's so much noise. And I do wish that with podcasting, people wouldn't just start sometimes. They put a little extra thought into what they want out of a show, what they're trying to give to their audience. So I think that it's a double-edged sword. It's so amazing there's all these opportunities, but I do wish people thought through their content slightly more. But that's the world we live in.
You've got to shape it, Juliet. Shape is like a loving sculptor will actually craft the whole thing through. This is the important thing. You know, Rebecca's been sort of shaping the Midweek Drive for the last sort of 7 or 8 months, et cetera, for them to be. Rebecca, any questions you'd like to throw into the mix now?
Yeah, I'd love to stay on the topic of podcasts for now, if that's okay, because I've discovered so many new ones recently. And as you say, they're very accessible.
There's a very good one for Jason Whittaker or William Blake, by the way, that you can get through Siren Radio. I just put that out there.
There you go. Yeah, also very good one. But yeah, there's a lot of new ones, and I think they're very accessible for people to make, to access. And I was just wondering if you had any advice for people that want to create their own podcast, because I think there's so much potential out there. Is it a case of just, you know, focusing on what you enjoy?
So my number one advice for podcasting is kind of back to my point, anyone can do it, right? So what sets you apart? Is it your past experiences? You know, is there something that happened to you that's very unique that you want to share? Is it your ability to storytell? Is it, is it something that you are really, you have a lot of knowledge about, like, for instance, there's a girl who has a podcast. I'm helping her flush out. She's a flow artist. So she like does hooping and she does fire spinning and her whole thing is Burning Man. And she's like, well, no one wants to hear about that. there's an audience out there for that. Problem that happens with many, many podcasters and why there's so many out there is they think that they are just interesting because they're a unique snowflake. And yes, we are all unique creative snowflakes, but what is it that makes you so interesting? And I think that Armin can probably relate to that with acting. You know, anyone could say the lines on screen. Anyone can play a character, but what do you bring to the character that is really unique? So podcasting the same way, really think about what you want to give your audience and who that audience is. You know, you are not going to be liked by everyone and you're not going to be listened to by anyone, you know, if you don't have a very specific niche that you're trying to tap into, because people are attracted to passion. If you're passionate about something, it is magnetic and you can feel it. So if you get up there and talk about things you're not passionate about, which a lot of podcasters do, they just talk to talk, no one's going to listen to you for very long. So hit that passion and nail down it and just really double down on what you're doing and get super niche at first.
I love Julia, that. And is that how yours came about as well? Was it just you wanted somewhere to put your thoughts and feelings? Is that how yours came about? What was the inspiration behind yours particularly?
I really love letting people storytell. And so I wanted to give other people a platform to talk to me and to tell their stories because I really want people to feel less alone. It depends on the podcast. So I produce one about that's about pregnancy and birth, and I don't have any experience with that, but I help that host produce that show. So I just do research and help write scripts for him, but it's hyper niche. And then the one I do called Clearly Off Topic, that one is more because my friend wanted a podcast and I know how to podcast, to be quite honest. But now we are really niching down into what makes it special about our podcast. And that also helps with advertisers because ultimately we want a creative outlet, but I think ultimately we'd like to get paid as well. If you're hyper niche and you know exactly what you're doing, advertisers love that. And you can get advertisers specifically for those things. But yeah, how it came about, I love video. So personally, I'm always fighting to make a vodcast or make a podcast into a TV show. So for me, it just seemed like a one step towards that goal. But I do still love listening to podcasts. Yes. Armin, what were you going to say?
You actually answered the question that I was going to pose, but I have another question. How many podcasts have moved on to TV shows? That's fascinating to me.
You know, I need to look up the exact number, but I do know several, and I think it depends on who's doing the podcasting. If it's someone with a background in radio, it typically stays a podcast because it's so similar. There's a podcast called Lady Gang Podcast. And the three women who do that podcast are already famous in their own right. There's like an actress, there's a TV host, and the other girl is like a fashion icon. They all came from TV and from movies and stuff to create a podcast that then eventually now is on E! News. So I think if they started in TV and they're visual artists, they're going to take their podcast back. And if they started more so in radio, then they're typically going to stay just podcasting. And what the numbers are showing is that if you include video, whether it's just a video of you talking to a microphone or it's a fully produced TV show, people want to listen to podcasts that have video more so than just audio. I don't know why. I do think people just like to see who's talking.
That's great. Thank you very much. If I may just put a slight spin on that, perhaps I have learned from my study of Shakespeare that culture went from an audio sort of appreciation. They went to the plays to hear a play, not to see a play. Whereas here in the 21st century, we are more visually oriented. So if you add the visual to it, it becomes more intriguing.
Absolutely. I think you're 100% right. Why do you think that shift occurred? Because we could always see.
I think because language was in flux at that time, and so listening to this new thing called modern English might have been very attractive, just as we listened to hip hop and that was a big thing when it came out because it was a new way to approach language. So I think that had something to do with it.
Jason, let's bring you in at this particular point.
Yeah.
As a scholar in this field, listening to Armin and Juliet there, is this jiving with your own particular views on the way that journalism is going to be changing in the 21st century?
Actually, rather than just journalism, there's a bigger question. Something I wrote about several years ago called the Gutenberg parenthesis. So this argument amongst some media scholars that actually what we're looking at, when we look at the age of print, we're looking at a brief interruption in the long history of communications, that it started as oral There's a long history of writing, but until Gutenberg's press came along, very, very few people had access to any form of writing. It was a scriptural culture. Very few people could write. Books were incredibly expensive, incredibly laborious to produce. Gutenberg, of course, starts bringing down the cost. It starts bringing down the price. But actually, that what we're probably looking at now is an eruption of audiovisual culture again. And so if you put what particularly, you know, I'm an English scholar, and William Blake printing books, that there's nothing more profoundly print based than Blake's culture. So I have a huge amount of time for this. But this is probably an interruption in the long history of communications, and that actually the more, I hate the word natural, but the easier means of communication for us to engage with is not the printed word, but actually the spoken word in some shape or form. So that actually print has been the anomaly. Text has been the anomaly. It won't go away. You know, we now have hugely literate cultures, which were not the place. You know, at Shakespeare's time, I'm not 100% sure what the literacy rates amongst the population were, but certainly it wasn't until much later in the 18th century where I'm studying that you suddenly get mass markets for books because people can actually read them, and into the 19th century. So not just journalism, media generally, we're moving towards this return to the audiovisual.
It obviously is good for Walter Ong and his orality history, let alone Elizabeth Eisenstein. Actually,
I spent a lot of time reading Walter Ong, and I'm a big fan of his work.
He's a good sir. Sometimes I found if you're caught between Walter Ong and Elizabeth Eisenstein, it's a bit like being caught between Sarah Michelle Gellar and indeed Alison Hannigan there. You know, suddenly you think you're torn between the two. And strangely enough, I've often seen yourself, Jason, as a kind of Principal Snyder of the University of Lincoln, really. Just a thought there.
And of course, once again, you refer to these pop culture references, and I've got no idea what you're talking about.
Alex is being very kind about my career, is what he's talking about. So there's no reason for you to know anything about that.
I know. The frightening thing is, of course, Armin, that Buffy the Vampire Slayer started, I think, before. Well, actually, Kirsty, you were probably with us. Rebecca hadn't even been born, but still, never mind.
My mum was a huge Buffy fan. When she found out about this, she was like, I love Principal Snyder. She was like, I'm going to sit in the background and watch. And I was like, no, you're not, because you're going to talk all the time. So she's a huge fan.
Well, thank your mother.
There we are. It's nice to see we're actually getting the parents involved from that point of view. Armin, any questions you'd like to put to the team? We've got a range of here from generations, ages, etc. Juliet, of course, doing some awesome work and also some fantastic fundraising she's been doing herself because of her experience in the health industry as well. Where would you like to go?
Well, with that prompt, then I'm going to go to Juliet first, and ask her what charities, specifically medical charities, are you advocating for that you have been a promoter of?
I'm not entirely sure where Alex got that information, but there's no specific charities I'm advocating for. But my mom, for 6 years ago, she suffered a ruptured brain aneurysm and then a TBI 2 months after that, and has been in an amazing recovery due to a lot of work from my husband and I and my father. That's a very long story short with that one, but just seeing firsthand the holes and the shortcomings of our medical industry and the need to have patient advocates there who know the system and can help someone navigate it, who in my mom's case, you know, she mentally was not able to and still has quite a bit of trouble mentally being able to navigate those things. You know, I really am passionate about investigating where the flaws are in our medical system and how to fix them, because it's not necessarily the fault of the nurses and the doctors and the institutions. It's the fault of like how we're paying them, how many hours they have to be worked. And really, we're setting up for failure in that regard. There are truly wonderful, wonderful people in the industry as well. And really, how do we make more of those and less of the ones that are overworked and maybe the handoffs not being proper? And you have experience with this with your wife as well, I'm sure. Not all practices and people are created equally, for sure.
Our hats off to the people that go the extra mile to help people, because without them, it would be a very cruel world.
One person can change the entire trajectory of your treatment, of your care. Just one small speck of kindness or one small bit of information that you didn't have completely changes things. And I know that you've experienced that.
Yes, my wife's survival actually has to do with a doctor that went the extra mile and did an extra test, which showed up the pancreatic cancer, and so that they could get to it relatively early. The The problem with pancreatic cancer is that once you begin to have the symptoms, it's already too late. Mm-hmm. But thank you for that, Juliet. And then I guess for Jason, the question that's usually asked me, and I will pose it to you, why Blake? Usually for me, it's why Shakespeare. But why Blake? What about Blake's writing was the inspiration for a life's work?
The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. Ah. So Blake in 1790 produced a book, quite frankly, one of the strangest little pamphlets ever written, in which he argued that essentially everything you know about everything is wrong. You know, truth is on the side of the devils, the angels are forces of repression. And I read this at the age of 19, and I had been raised as a very good Catholic boy until that point. Was struggling with some personal issues of kind of leaving home and realizing that maybe I hadn't been told the truth about everything. Read this book and literally, I mean, I usually say the lights went on and they haven't gone off ever since. It encouraged me to read everything and anything I could by Blake. And I don't agree with Blake on everything. I disagree on lots of things, but actually that's part of Blake's modus operandi. He likes the mental fight. So he likes you to disagree. He's not looking for followers, actually.
And if he were looking for followers, if I were to say to you, what should I read first from Blake in order to become as enthusiastic as you are, what would you suggest?
I would recommend that the one that is still Blake's masterpiece and is deceptively simple is Songs of Innocence and of Experience. You know, that is almost pure poetry in a whole host of forms, both metrically, both in terms of the simplicity of themes, which is then incredibly complicated. Another, if you wanted to engage, I think actually probably my favourite book, aside from The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, is Visions of the Daughters of Albion. This is his response to Mary Wollstonecraft's Vindication of the Rights of Women. It's an incredibly, I mean, as far as I can tell, Blake is the first male writer to actually engage with Wollstonecraft's feminism and to do so in quite a positive rather than a dismissive light. I think William Godwin, who Blake also knew, was the other man who did the same. But also, as what's really important to Blake is that in that book, he also then offers one of the, to this day, in my opinion, the most complex refutations of Locke and this notion that we only learn from everything that's outside us, that actually our perceptions are formed by our desires, by this kind of interior agency, what elsewhere he calls poetic genius. And I've actually found that incredibly, profoundly influential on the way that I think about the relationship between the arts, the sciences, between my own engagement with the world around us, that we too often allow ourselves to be seen as passive recipients of fate, of events, of atoms hitting us randomly. And the Visions of the Daughters of Albion was a reaction to women's oppression, but also then human oppression, that when we allow our mind to be seen as passive, we will become passive beings. We will be enslaved by the world around us. So the Vision of the Daughters of Albion, it's also relatively easy to understand by the standards of Blake's writing.
Thank I think you in many that. Ways, Jason, what we actually need to look at is rather like Armin can actually have the bard himself in his hands there with respect to obviously Shakespeare and so on. We need to have a miniature model of Blake for your good self to obviously sort of have that similar sort of experience.
My really. Blake's head is upstairs, but I'll just try. This is so my book that came out earlier this year. This is a biography and a guide to Blake's work. So I have to get. I'm sorry. I'm contractually obliged by my publisher to get a pitch in.
Jason, it wouldn't be radio or indeed podcasting if we didn't have the ubiquitous book plug in there. And let's face it, if we can promote Illyria again, probably the best dramatic little routine in terms of Shakespeare you could ever wish to go through. The least we can do is promote your good self as well. Kirsty, we're back with your good self again. We've moved very dexterously from obviously Deep Space Nine through Buffy, through Blake, through medical treatment in the States and other aspects and so on. Where do you want to take us now?
I was just going to touch on the subject of Shakespeare because I wanted to ask Armin, why do you think that so many young people disconnect with Shakespeare? Do you think it's a failure in teaching or do you think it's a lack of desire in young people to understand complex texts?
I think those are both the answer, but I think the primary reason is a failure in teaching. As a teacher, that's egotistical of me to say, because I think I teach it right. But I believe it's a lack of understanding because teachers aren't as fully cognizant of the rules of rhetoric, which is how Shakespeare wrote. And once you become cognizant of those rules and how he wrote and why he put words together the way he did, then the language becomes that much clearer and the writing becomes that much more inspirational. I also think that most teachers are baffled by Shakespeare, and that perception comes across to the class, so that the teachers are looking for something to teach that day, and the students can feel that. The other thing is, as we become more and more of a visual culture, the appreciation for language has disappeared. And I think once students are reintroduced to the appreciation of language, I think then their appreciation of Shakespeare and possibly Blake, I'm sure it's quite the same thing, becomes exponentially greater.
And so you said that you engage your students in Shakespeare. What do you do to engage them?
First of all, I make them understand through example, lots of examples of how easy Shakespeare is to understand once you have the metric of rhetorical understanding behind you. Once you understand that to be or not to be is a instance of antithesis, which is one of the figures of rhetoric, and they begin to key in to elements. It's like anything else. If I have no understanding of baseball in Britain is called
cricket or rounders, or cricket, one of those two.
Okay, so I know nothing about cricket, nothing whatsoever. Obviously, I think I just proved that. And so I don't understand the game because I have no understanding of it. But once you have an understanding of the rules of why it's played, what the strategies are, then all of a sudden it becomes quite fascinating. It's the same thing with Shakespeare or anything else. Once you have a key into how it works, then you can appreciate it.
Juliet, I'm fascinated. Did you actually do rhetoric when you were doing your broadcast journalism degree?
No, they don't teach us that in the States. Cal State Fullerton.
They don't teach us that here either.
Good.
Okay.
Good. Not only does it make you more appreciative of Shakespeare, but it makes you a better writer. It makes you a better listener. You're listening not just for words, but the relationship between words, how they fit together, why certain words are better as antitheses or juxtapositions or comparisons. Usually in American teaching, we get metaphors and similes and things.
Just losing you slightly there
nice stuff, but it does not, I shouldn't say that. It has something to do with the appreciation language, but not as great as the study of rhetoric.
I am now very inspired to go study that because I think that as humans, it's our job while we're here on Earth to continuously become better versions of ourselves. And you've definitely inspired me now. I'm like, oh, I could get better at something. Yes, this is now what I'm going to do.
Juliet, you know that the Midweek Drive goes for inspiration. You should know this. I know it's just your second show, but, you know, we work on that basis. Rebecca, I'm going to hand over to your good self to throw in any last sort of questions from your good point of view. Any thoughts you'd like to share with us?
I'd like to ask Armin, if it's okay. You did ask Jason what his text would be for people that haven't maybe come across Blake before. For people that aren't, you know, familiar with Shakespeare or perhaps aren't fans of Shakespeare but would like to be, where would you send them in a similar direction?
I would say my book.
That's a very good one.
Because it introduces you not only to the period, which is essential to the understanding of Shakespeare, mm-hmm. but also to the language. There are various books besides mine, of course. But I would say Anthony Burgess's biography of Shakespeare, which is a very simple one to read, is a great place for someone who wants to dip their toe into the Elizabethan culture.
And just in case people are wondering, it's Illyria or Betrayal of Angels, available online in all sorts of other marvellous ways from that point of view. It's also a great action adventure as well, and puts Shakespeare in a whole new light from that point of view. So highly recommended that. I even actually put up a 5-star review on Amazon about it. So, you know, that's rare indeed for me. Rebecca, it falls to your good self to actually throw the last two questions to the team. Off you go. In fact, you select whomever you wish to go to. Juliet, Jason, Armin, Kirsty, off you go.
Oh, no, I don't know which order to do it in. Can I not just throw it at the whole team?
No, we've got to select individuals. Go for it.
Okay, I'll just go in order of which you are on my screen. So, Armin, have you had a reasonably enjoyable Zoomer with us today?
I have indeed. Thank you. It always is a pleasure to do this. Not only do I get a chance to talk about my book, which is secondary, primarily, Alex brings on such interesting people that I'm fascinated by them and learn more about the world, things that I didn't know about. So, yes, I have.
Oh, wonderful. And Jason, have you today?
I've had a wonderful time. Thank you. It's been a very pleasant end to what was quite a complex day.
Yeah, it's therapy, Jason. Good. You know, this is my 17th Zoomer of the day. That includes 12 student assessment pieces on Microsoft Teams. So, you know, we need therapy to work through that. Just one more to go. Anyway, carry on, Rebecca.
Juliet, what about you?
It's always so enjoyable, and I echo what Armin was saying, that this is just such a wonderful show that brings together these differently like-minded people. You know, everyone has kind of the same common thread, but we all have different experiences, and really putting that all together is just inspiring, as it should be.
Kirsty, have you had an enjoyable time as well?
Yeah, I mean, it's my first time doing this, and I completely agree with what everyone said. I think it's really interesting to speak to people with similar views but different life experiences, because it's interesting to see, especially cross-generationally, how different people are interested in different things but can intrigue other people.
And we've been talking about books. Kirsty, would you like to give a shameless plug to the Festival of Learning, that's the online package for the University of Lincoln that's emerging in May sometime?
Yeah, I mean, I can try, but we don't have a date or a time. But yeah, within the next few weeks, we will be securing dates and times for the Festival of Learning, which will tie in basically everything that you can get involved with at the university, as well as we're hoping to put on some more festival style events as well that people can get involved in.
There you go. It's all wondrous stuff there. Rebecca, has it been good for you?
Yes, it's been lovely. Thank you. Always, marvellous, always a pleasure.
I take it we can also welcome back Armin, Juliet, Jason, Kirsty and Rebecca in the not-too-distant future. You will all return, hopefully. Excellent.
Yes,
I see the spirit of Blake is working through that. Happy trails for now. Keep on keeping on. And we will, all I will say is basically to our Californian friends, you're going to have a great Wednesday. I can say that because we've travelled through time in Britain and Wednesday's been perfectly okay from our end of the scale, etc. Boris Johnson's announced a new review of the pandemic in 2022, so I'm sure all will be well on that point of view. And we'll see you again very soon. Cheers for now.
Bye-bye.
Lil, do you think it's pronounced Norwich or Norwich?
Yes.
Right. Apart from a great cathedral, a soccer team referred to as the Canaries, and proximity to the North Sea, these days,
Norwich
can also proudly claim to have added Rebecca Bond to the hallowed ranks of key midweek drivettes.
On the tip of the top of a mountain all snowy, where the ice-swirling, toe-curling blizzards were blowy, in a herd full of huddling yaks, big and small, lived Gertie, the littlest yak of them all. We knew when this was published it was going to actually be awesome. We knew when it was shortlisted for Oscar's Book Prize 2021. It stood every chance and was absolutely going to be heading into that situation. And it's done it. It's gone and won it. It has actually done the business. It has succeeded. Huge congratulations to Lou Fraser. Well done, Lou, for actually launching this awesome text, The Littlest Yak. Truly tremendous.
Thank you so much, Alex. It completely surprised me and Kate, the illustrator that I work with. We can't quite believe it. Thank you.
Well, as you can see, basically, Kirsty has joined us now, and myself, we're just overwhelmed with little slack and joy and happiness. Just, I mean, awesome, awesome. And
thank
as I
you.
Say, you're so tempted to go yakety yak, don't talk back, but you're too young. let's not go down that whole system. Share with us, Lou, the notion of Gertie, the littlest yak in the whole herd, and she's feeling stuck in her smallness. She wants to grow up and have bigness. And tallness.
I thought it was a really nice idea to have a story about something we all want when we're little, which is to be bigger, because we all think that being bigger is great. And we all know as grown-ups, that sometimes being bigger is not great. And I thought it would be lovely to do a story about growing up and what it's like to stand in a toddler's shoes and to realise that actually being small can be amazing.
You see, if only Kirsty had had the littlest yak when she was actually supervising her flatmates' children a wee while ago, all would be well with the world. But Kirsty, you've had a look at some of Lou's awesome material. I mean, any thoughts that you'd like to share with Lou about your own thoughts on the littlest yak?
I just think it's a really sweet concept for a book. And I think that it is true that I think a lot of children are, it's that thing of you always get bullied for standing out. So I think it's a really sweet idea to sort of champion standing out. And I just wanted to ask you, why do you think that like the topics that are covered in The Littlest Yak are so relevant to like the modern world, I guess?
I think some of the books that resonate the most with children are the ones that are perennial themes, things that don't change no matter what decade we live in. So the idea of growing up, the idea of finding something difficult, the idea of trying again and again and again until we succeed. I think those themes last forever. And I didn't set out to pick that theme sort of consciously with that in mind. It just happened. Gertie just happened. And it was only really when I'd finished and I looked back and I thought that's the kind of story that doesn't date. And I really like that about children's books, where they're applicable, whether it's this generation or the next generation or the one after.
Now, we spoke with James Ashton, of course, the father of the awesome and sadly late Oscar Ashton, about obviously the establishment of Oscar's Book Prize. It's now in its eighth year. I know when we were going through the shortlists, I had a sneaking feeling, actually, Lou, that the Littlest Yak had a real chance from that point of view. But from your own perspective, I mean, just going through that process until the announcement was made, literally today, yeah. What's it been like? Has it literally been a whirlwind of emotions and such? Like, was it a case of punch the air and thank goodness I haven't got my Zoom camera on now because I'm going crazy?
You know, I cried a lot. I have cried a lot this afternoon, and I really didn't, and I don't think Kate did either. Either of us didn't expect to win. And I kept, even on the shortlist, I kept waiting for the email to tell me, oh, I'm really sorry, we've made a mistake. And it never came. And so when I went, you know, to see who was going to be the winner of the Oscars Book Prize 21, I really didn't expect it to be us. Kate and I were, I think for a few seconds, just quite stunned. But I have cried a lot since then. It seems to be all I've done all afternoon, I'm afraid, Alex.
I mean, it's been a dream team, Lou, in many ways, because you mentioned, Kate, of course, that's Kate Hindley, the illustrator, yes. Also, of course, of the book. And obviously, it's a children's book. But I mean, looking at some of the illustrations that we've seen already online of The Littlest Yak and so on, I mean, what's not to love about Gertie? I mean, she's just awesome. I mean, was that something you had in mind when you were actually producing this whole thing? As I say, The Littlest Yak, the perfect book to snuggle up with at home.
Well, it's funny, when I write, and a lot of my picture book friends have very clear ideas about the visuals, and I'm the opposite. I don't have any ideas at all. I completely try and leave my mind blank when I write about the visual side, because I think it's really important that I hand it over to Kate and that Kate gets completely free rein to do whatever she thinks is right. You know, I'm only 50% of the picture book. And I just love the moment. I can remember it quite clearly when I opened my computer and I saw Kate's first ever sketch of Gertie. And I knew the moment I saw her that I would never ask Kate to change her in any way, because she was far better than anything I could have ever imagined myself. And I kind of wish that I'd come up with some of the cool stuff, like the bobble hat and all the woolly stuff, the knitwear, but I didn't. That's all Kate, I'm afraid. I can't take any credit for that.
I mean, Lou, the merchandising opportunities for Littlest Yak through the roof now. Absolutely through the roof. I'm amazed Disney are not already knocking on your door and saying, we need Gertie the Littlest Yak and so on. I'm intrigued, Lou, of course, you actually write in a shed in the garden.
I do. I'm sat here right now.
You're in your garden shed working through that. Is that something where you just thought, I need to be alone? Because obviously we hear about, obviously some writers actually need that sort of isolation, etc. Is it a creative shed? Do you have aspects of Gertie around you?
I do. I really envy the writers who are able to write sort of like sat in cafes, people like J.K. Rowling, and, you know, and can cope with the noise. I can't. I'm just not that good. I really need to shut myself away somewhere where no one can disturb me. And I think also being a mum, as a mum, you're always on call, aren't you? So it's quite good to remove yourself from the house and actually shut the door and try and get some peace and quiet. And I think when you write in rhyme, it's really important, because the rhythm of other people's speech can really interrupt the rhythm of your rhyme. So I really need to be away, but I do have lots of Gertie things in my shed. I do. I have a height chart and cutouts and books and all sorts.
Now, of course, you said you're not that good. I think we have to add the caveat, yet, Lou, because let's face it, The Littlest Jack is actually your picture book debut. I mean, you know, to actually sort of hit the home run first out the gate, that must be something where you think, yeah, maybe I've actually struck on something pretty good with this one.
Well, I did think this after, and I thought, well, maybe I can do this after all. So that was a lovely moment. And I think I've admired and watched the Oscars Book Prize since its inception. I've always been astounded by the quality of the shortlist. And I had added it to a list of dreams, actually, for something I wanted to do one day, was to be shortlisted for this prize. I couldn't quite believe it when it happened with my first book. It's left me a bit worried about what I'm going to do next, to be honest.
Well, I suppose there is that sort of line. I mean, it's like Mozart, you know, you think, how can I actually follow that through at that sort of age from that point of view? Did you actually test The Littlest Jack out with any testing audiences? I mean, I'm thinking about children and so on. Was it kind of given any kind of test beta readings and so on?
Well, do you know something? It's funny. I've tested a lot of my books with my godchildren, but Gertie and The Littlest Jack was one that I didn't. And actually, some of the testing for this occurred with my editor, who has two very lovely nephews, and also with my agent, who also has nephews. And so there was a bit of testing that went on there. And actually, I had some great feedback from one of the nephews, which actually made me change the final lines of Gertie.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Kirsty, Gertie. I can see a sequel coming up, Lou. You see what I'm going here? Yeah, when Gertie meets Kirsty. Kirsty, any questions you might have to add to what we've been talking about so far?
I was just wondering, where did the name Gertie come from?
You know, I love that question. I get asked it a lot. And do you know something? I have no idea. I think it's just a name I've always loved. If I could have got away with it, I might have called my daughter Gertie, but my husband had his idea set somewhere else, and so we didn't use it. But I've always loved the name and wanted to put it in something, and it must have just popped up in my subconscious, something I'd forgotten from decades ago, and it just happened. She walked into my head fully formed, and her name was Gertie. I don't think I even got a say in it, to be honest.
Well,
and do you think that you'll, now that you've won the prize money, do you think you'll update the shed, or do you think the shed will stay the shed?
Well, you know, I have recently updated the shed. It's had a lick of paint. It's looking much better. But I do think there are some things I could do with some more bookshelves. I think my husband's a little bit fed up of big piles of books all over the floor. So I might invest a little bit in tidying up, because I think that might keep the family happy. I am quite messy with my books, I'm afraid.
And do you have, so for anyone else, because obviously you said this was your first time,
yes,
writing a picture book. For people that are thinking of writing picture books, do you have any words of advice for them?
I think probably the most important thing is to not write what you think the marketplace needs. It's to write what you really believe in, what really matters. Because I think if you write that and you write honestly, then your emotion and your passion and your story will come together. I think you mustn't ever write just because you want to be the next Julia Donaldson, or you want to be the next, you know, whatever. I think you need to write because you need to write, and because it's in you and you have a story to tell. I think you should just go with the flow and not look too much at the marketplace or the trends, and just write from your heart. That's what I try and do. Don't always get it right, but that's what I try and do.
Absolutely. And working with Kate Henley, of course, she's had a bit more experience in terms of obviously her experience of the award-winning You Must Bring a Hat and so on, and indeed the Royal Rabbits of London. Were there any sort of senses in terms of when you built that relationship together that you felt, yeah, this is magic, this is going to work together, we're going to work well?
I think Kate is just phenomenal. She's epic. She doesn't need me in any way. She's a brilliant writer of her own accord. She doesn't need me at all. Can't quite believe she said yes. I think because we're both quite laid back and we both have great respect for each other's areas, you know, it works quite well, because I just need to get Kate to get on with her bit, and she just needs me to get on with my bit. And then when we come together, you know, then we have a little bit of jiggling to fit around each other, but hardly anything. I think we think very much in the same way. But most importantly, we've got a brilliant team at Simon & Schuster, a creative director and an editing director who, you know, help both of us work in the same direction. So we're all coming from the same, we all start, you know, from the same basis. We all want the same thing. We're all reading from the same page. And that makes a huge difference when you've got a team helping you all flow in the right direction. It allows you a little bit of space.
Well, I think it's fair to say, Lou, that just as Dickens actually was immortalised with the best of times, the worst of times, and A Tale of Two Cities, somehow in centuries to come, we look at on the tip of the top of a mountain all snowy, where the ice-swirling, toe-curling blizzards were blowy, in a herd full of huddling yaks, big and small, lived Gertie, the littlest yak of them all. Awesome. How can people get hold of the littlest yak, Lou? Where can they actually go to find things? Is it all the usual online places and so on and so forth?
All the usual. Lovely independent bookshops have been hugely supportive all the way across the country. Obviously online, and obviously all the usual suspects as well. So wherever I turn, there seems to be a Gertie. I don't think you'll have trouble finding her.
And clearly you can obviously sort of access Oscar's book prize as well to find the whole thing through. Once again, huge congratulations, Lou. Delighted that you actually sort of were successful. And congratulations to Gertie as well, because let's face it, Lou, these fictional characters in some dimension, they actually exist. They are real, of course. So
they are very real, Alex.
Yeah. So we've got two final questions to wrap up with. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the programme today?
Oh, fantastic. Absolutely lovely.
Well, the next critical question is, Lou, will you kindly return in the not too distant future, will you come back with more tales of the littlest yak?
Well, it's funny you should say that, but guess what Kate and I are working on next? And I'd love to come back and talk to you about it. There's more yak. She's coming back.
We can do yakety yak.
You can.
Take out the papers and the trash. Are you don't get no spending cash. If you don't scrub that kitchen floor. Just finish cleaning up your room. Let's see that dust fly with that broom. Get all that garbage out of sight. Or you don't go out Friday night. Yaggity yak!
Don't talk back.
You just put on your coat and hat.
Back.
Yaggity yak!
Don't go back.
Yaggity yak!